Are you obsessed with Los Angeles? Head over heels in love with the City of Angels? Well, this is the podcast for you. At Life Hacks LA, we hack the best in arts, eats, and activities in Los Angeles. So join us and become an LA hacker. Hey, what is up, LA hackers? This is your host, Stefan. And welcome to another episode of the Life Hacks LA podcast. Okay, I have to let you know that I'm so excited for this episode. Ever since I first started this podcast, I've had today's guest on my list of people I one day want to interview. And that's because as someone who loves LA entertainment, loves LA experiences, and loves LA history, I've been a huge admirer of the work of today's guest, Bobby Green from the 1933 Group. If you haven't heard the name, I'm sure you have at least heard of some of the projects he's been involved with that include the Highland Park Bowl, the Formosa Cafe, Idle Hour, Bigfoot Lodge, Tale of the Pup, and the list goes on and on and on. The cool thing about these bars and restaurants is that not only are they an experience that transports you to another time, not only are they absolutely gorgeous with top-notch food, service, and drinks and vibes, but in many cases, they are a deep part of LA history. Some of these classic LA spots were renovated and brought back to life by Bobby and his partners. So as I mentioned, LA history is important to them, and they are not only preserving Los Angeles history in their work today, but at the same time, they're creating new LA history for future generations to enjoy. Okay, guys, let's jump right into this conversation with Bobby Green from the 1933 Group, and make sure you come back on the other side of the interview as I'll share my special hack for this episode. Hey, what's going on, LA Hackers? Our guest today is Bobby Green from the 1933 Group. How are you doing today, Bobby?
Very good, Stefan. Thank you.
Well, I was just telling you, it's great to have you on. I've been a longtime admirer of your work, and I've been wanting to speak to you ever since I pretty much started this podcast, so this is exciting for me. Before we jump into the 1933 Group and everything you're doing with that, I wanted to share with the audience a little bit more about you. Where are you from originally, and how did you make your way to LA?
Well, originally born in Oklahoma, a little town called Enid, Oklahoma. But my family and I started coming out here probably when I was around 9-10 years old. It's that classic LA story of, you know, the mom who wants their kids to, you know, get into commercials and so starts bringing them to LA. And it kind of spun out of control. And next thing you know, we were moving here. I think it was 1980 and I was 10. And so that was my introduction to LA. And I think that's what set my fascination with LA from day one, because when you're juxtaposed from an environment, say like Oklahoma, where it's just flat and windy, and my family were farmers, they farmed wheat and cattle, and my dad was an artist, and then you come to LA at such a young age, you know, to me that was the big city. I didn't know what New York looked like, I didn't know what Chicago looked like, but LA was this massive big city, and It was kind of like going to Disneyland. It was like all of LA to me was an extension of this thematic, over the top fun place. That's where I just got immersed into, and just the sight of a palm tree alone, or a street lined with palm trees, you know, it was just so dramatic, you know, for a kid coming from somewhere with no trees.
Yeah, it must have been a big change, and it's kind of interesting though that you sort of are in the entertainment industry. I mean, you sort of are that way.
I know, it's so funny. You know, so when I was young, I was kind of, I'm not going to say forced into the entertainment industry, but, you know, I didn't really have much of a choice, and I was so young, I didn't really know. But I actually hated it. The older I got and the more into my teenage years I got, I just despised it, because, you know, I just wanted to go skateboarding with my friends, or dye my hair green, or you know, all the things that teenagers, you know, usually do. But I couldn't do that, and you know, constantly having to go to Hollywood or audition for something, and so the very last thing I did, I got cast in that movie Scrooged, the Bill Murray Christmas movie. Yeah, yeah. I was one of his Dickens carolers. It was me and like four other boys, and that was the last thing I did. I turned 18 when that finished, or during that filming, and I just immediately quit as soon as I turned 18. I'm like, I hate this. This is the most. I want to do things. I don't want to sit around in a trailer all day and be stressed out by directors yelling at people.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like a fun life for kids.
No, it's not. It's really not. I mean, it's funny because, you know, I'm on TV more now than I probably ever was back then. But at least now it's like on my terms, you know. And if I am on TV, well, and I'm on a show talking about something that I do or love. So it's totally different than just being directed to do whatever you're told to do.
Yeah, well, let's jump into that, Bobby, what you're actually known for. So we'll get into more detail later, but just in general, so the audience knows, what are some of the projects that you have going on with the 1933 group?
Well, we have been doing this now for 23 years. The first place we opened, this was in 1999, if you can believe it, was the Bigfoot Lodge. After the Bigfoot Lodge and the success of that place, we just kind of went on a roll opening kind of vintage inspired themed bars. And we did the Thirsty Crow, we did the Little Cave and several others. And then a little later in our company, we got more into actually preserving historical places and Idle Hour in the Valley, and then the Formosa and the Highland Park Bowl. And now, of course, we're working on Tale of the Pup, which is to me the pinnacle of them all. For years and years, we were always best known for the Bigfoot Lodge. Funny enough, because I think because it was so early on, you know, it was in the late 90s, and it was so far out of the way at the time, and it was such a big hit. And so most people that I start telling them, you know, the places I own, as soon as I come to Bigfoot, they go, "Oh, the Bigfoot! Oh, yeah. I met my wife there," or something like that.
That's very cool.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the details of that story, because I know you started off at the coffee shop on your own and then you hooked up with some partners. Can you talk about like what it takes to convince someone of your crazy idea to build these thematic bars and restaurants? And I know you started with the Bigfoot, like you convinced them of to go in with you, that see your vision, and then you guys just kind of gradually went on and got bigger and bigger.
Yeah, you know, that's one of those stories that I always tell people that I meet that are younger, and I can tell they have a drive or they have an ambition in life or whatever. I usually tell them the story of how I was able to convince people to, you know, open a bar with me. And it's a lot of persistence and a lot of patience is what it really came down to. But, you know, even before the little coffee house, which we opened in, I guess, around 93 or 94, before that, I just loved throwing parties. And, you know, I grew up going to parties, like high school keggers or college parties. And to me, they were just always so boring and bland. It was like, okay, you grabbed a few bottles of food and you grilled up something on the grill. But to me, I always wanted something more exciting. So I would throw these thematic parties with whatever measly budget I had, because I didn't come from a wealthy family or anything. So I was, you know, using my creativity and my art skills to come up with all these themes. I remember I lived in Santa Monica and I built out this tiki little backyard, like a giant tiki bar. And so we throw all these super elaborate tiki parties back in the 90s. So I naturally had a love of entertaining people and partying and enjoying life with people in kind of a environment that took people away from their regular lives. And so then that kind of carried over. We got a chance to open the coffee house with some friends. And first thing I did was to remodel it, you know, and make it a theme. And we decided to do a tiki sci-fi theme. We mixed kind of vintage sci-fi and tiki together. That was super fun. And people really responded to it. And it attracted people back then, you know, the types that would seek out interesting places. And so I got to meet all these incredible and creative people. And so I loved what I was doing. I loved the coffee house environment. And this is granted, pre-Starbucks days of coffee houses. So this is much more bohemian, much more like a bar environment, but for the under 21 crowd, obviously. So it was kind of the place where you would show up and there'd be different art shows happening all the time. And you would stay for hours and hours and play backgammon or chess or cards and talk with friends. So it was that kind of environment. And I loved it. And I worked the counter, me and my partner at the time, we were the only employees. So I was there four nights a week. I got to meet so many people. And this is in my early 20s. And so I decided I want to do this, but I got to find a way to make money. So I was going to Hollywood. I was going to bars at that time. And so to me, that was the next step. You know, take it to the next level and open a bar in LA. Of course, the first thing I do is come up with an idea or a theme for it. You know, that was the Bigfoot Lodge. Let's think about something that the city doesn't have and is so completely different than LA that when people walk in, they're going to be wowed by it, but also very warm and comfortable and inviting. I remember going skiing as a kid with my parents in Colorado and Twin Peaks was on at the time and it was really popular. And I just loved that warm, you know, log cabin-like aesthetic. And so came up with the idea, but needed the money to do it. And so what I had done is since I was an artist or a designer, I made a book. I made like my own little book at Kinko's, you know, and I had friends do illustrations for it. And, made the spiral bound book and I printed off about, I don't know, maybe 10 of them. And so I would keep them on me all the time. And whenever I'd come across somebody that, you know, I thought had money or their parents had money or that, you know, they were interested in what I was doing, I would give them a book and I'd say, this is what I want to do. This is what it's going to be. You know, this is what it's going to be like. And I need partners to, you know, invest in it. And I did that for 3 years. I did have moments of giving up. You know, I always tell people that, like, sure, you know, I'd give up for a few months, but then my inspiration would come back and I would just start again. And I would just keep giving this book out. And of course, back then I had tons of promissory notes. You know, I had all these people go, yeah, I'll pitch in, you know, I'll throw 10 grand in, I'll put 20 grand in. But when it really all came down to it, nobody really put anything in it. It came down to a friend of a friend gave the book to one of their friends who were running a clothing company at the time. And they were the same age as me. So they're in their 20s. They're hardworking, enterprising people. And all they want to do is just make things happen for themselves. And so a friend gave them the book and said, listen, you should meet with this guy because he knows tons of people. And I'm sure this thing will be successful. And so that's how it happened. You know, after 3 years, you know, we sit down at a table. And during that time, I was going out to all these different little bars around town and just like trying to figure out who owned it. And if the owner was there, I would talk to him and say, hey, are you interested in selling this place? You know, because those are the two things I needed was a capital and location.
Yeah.
You know, and even if it was a non-English speaking place, I would take a friend with me that, you know, spoke whatever language that little spot was, you know, and so I was really into it. I was really persistent about it.
Yeah. So it's good old fashioned grind and hustle.
Yeah, really, honestly. And that's what it is. You know, LA is a land of opportunity. And I always tell people that if you just hustle in an honest way, you can accomplish anything in this town. And I feel like that's what I did. I just nosed to the grindstone and made it happen. And so my partners were like, great, yeah, let's do it. And I had just found a place in Atwater Village, which at that time was nowhere. It was across the river, people used to call it. Oh, that's across the river. Of course, now it's a great place to live. But back in the 90s, it was you know, Silver Lake was kind of like, well, if you're past Silver Lake, it's too far. It's funny to think back about it. And so we did it. We just, we made it happen. We opened Bigfoot Lodge in June of 99.
That's awesome. And I love the story. I mean, the main message I'm getting from you there is no matter what, don't quit if you're passionate about it. I mean, so many successful people have the same story of if they had quit Well, obviously, if they had quit, they would have never made it. But they're so close to quitting. So there's so many success stories out there that didn't happen just because the person ended up quitting, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. Stay positive and don't quit. That's the key.
Okay. So just to give our audience an idea as well, I mean, we're talking 20 years ago. I mean, I think people are used to these over-the-top thematic bars and restaurants that are, you know, transportational experiences. But this is back in the day when it wasn't really happening. You guys were one of the first to do it. So what are your thoughts over the last, I'd say like 10 years, especially the Arts District and downtown? There's been a lot of places that, you know, been kind of coming up with these themes of like transporting you. You're not just coming in there for a drink, you're coming in there to escape. But what are your thoughts on the LA restaurant and bar scene over the last 10 years?
You're right. I always look back in the beginning when we did that. And to me, creating a fully immersive themed bar at the time that I did it, to me, wasn't like I was starting something new. It was, to me, it was like I was continuing a tradition that had been happening for decades. Because since I was always a vintage head and a vintage lover, I was frequenting the places that were like that, and they were built that way in the 40s or in the 50s. And so I was inspired by the past. And I was a little dismayed that people had kind of stopped doing that, you know, in the, say, in the 70s and the 80s, that tradition of thematic spaces had kind of stopped. So I just wanted to keep that tradition going. I didn't realize that other people were looking at what I was doing as something new. I guess it was new because it was kind of the new wave or the neo version of what our grandparents had done. And I realized, I think we kind of set a new bar or set a new trend for people, because the success of it, the success of the Bigfoot right off the bat, was so large that I think people took notice, like, oh, wow, these people kind of did something a little off the cuff, a little more daring than your average place, and it's well received. Of course, that was a great risk. But to me, my passion for that type of thing counteracted the risk fear. So that's why it worked. And I did notice that over the last 20 years, there, you know, everyone has kind of tried to one up each other in a sense.
Definitely.
You know, spend a bit more money and more focus on design. You know, I think it's wonderful, to be honest with you. I love it. And there's some that really nail it, and there's some that don't. And I think with anything in life, whatever you create has to come from a true passion, a place of true passion. And for me, the entire world of vintage, the entire world of the 21st century that we've, the 20th century that America's created, to me has always been my passion. The aesthetic, the feeling, the image of it, I think it comes through naturally with what we do.
Yeah, definitely does. And let's talk about that, because you have so many venues, but a few of them are very historical in nature. And I know you like to restore some of that history. And in some of these cases, you've saved the places or brought them back. So there's so many, but maybe you could just pick one to talk about that has this historical significance to Los Angeles that you guys helped restore.
It's hard to just talk about one, really.
Yeah.
You know, because so each one has such a different uniqueness that it brought to LA. The bowling alley, for instance, you know, we're talking about 1927 when that was built. And of course, it was built under the guise of kind of cheating prohibition at the time. It was built by a pharmacy company that was selling prescription booze, you know, because there was a loophole in the law. You could prescribe booze. And so this pharmacy company decides to build a complex that houses doctors, pharmacy, and entertainment in one space. I mean, it's actually brilliant. It's not a speakeasy. It's completely, you know, right there on the surface. So, you know, that's some incredible LA history. You've got the Idle Hour, which when it was built as a two-story wooden barrel, was not that unique. There was probably about 10, 11 barrels around Los Angeles at the time. But what's unique about the space is after it closed, you know, when it closed in the 80s, And the woman that owned it decided to just live in the building. So the fact that she lived in this building for 35 years is what created the place as a time capsule. It was not torn down. It would have been. It probably should have been. I mean, all the others were. But she saved it and saved it for us to come along.
I didn't even know any others existed until you just said that. I thought that's amazing.
When you take that deep dive into programmatic architecture, programmatic architecture is what they call, sometimes mimicry architecture, vernacular architecture. It's architecture that kind of like conveys what it does. So if it's a giant shoe, it's a shoe store. If it's a giant hat, maybe it's a restaurant. LA was covered in them. If you pick up Jim Hyman's book, Crazy, Beyond Crazy or Crazy LA, incredible book filled with photographs of all these places we had all over Los Angeles. You realize what a theme park LA was. And a barrel was a common style to build. So I've been told by historians that there were about 10 or 11 barrels total around Los Angeles.
Wow.
Remarkable. So the fact that this one survived thanks to 35 years of squatting is a remarkable story in itself. And of course, the Formosa. The Formosa is, I think, most people's ultimate Los Angeles memory. Mm-hmm. And a beautiful place because it never closed or it never got torn down or remodeled. It kind of always stayed in business since 1939 and went through various stages of being loved or unloved or doing well or not doing well and falling apart, but it always survived. We were very fortunate to be chosen, really. We were actually chosen for that job because a lot of people wanted to be the one to come in and do something with the Formosa, the great location. But the property owners knew that it needed the right type of people to come along and do it justice for the history of it. So we were fortunate to be chosen. And it was because of our track record. We'd already done the bowling alley and the Idle Hour. I just feel so incredibly lucky to start a career where I am adding to the tradition of these unique places, creating new places, and then getting to come all the way full circle back around to saving the places that inspired me in the first place and restore them and bring them back. I just feel the greatest sense of joy when I get to do these things.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I mean, these are just incredibly beautiful places that are so important to the history of Los Angeles, and you're creating new history. I mean, you could go in there and not know anything about the history and still enjoy a beautiful venue, a great night with cocktails and good food. So really, really incredible. I wanted to ask you, I mean, there's other historic bars and restaurants in Los Angeles, obviously, that you guys aren't involved with. You mentioned that, there's some that do it right and some that don't. Can you talk about a few that you admire, like from the outside looking in, like you say, okay, wow, this is a really impressive venue with some amazing history. And here in 2022, they're still providing a great experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Originally I was always just drawn to the original places, go to Musso and Frank's and have a cocktail. Shea J's, for instance, at Santa Monica. I love what I call a time travel experience. And if the moment is just right and the environment is just right, you could be transported to another place in another time, the music, whatever is happening in that environment. And I always seek out these time travel experiences whenever I can. And I get those a bit at the historic places, but the few places that I do get that are part of the new genre of vintage, I've always been a fan of Warner Ebbing's place, Little Dom's. Mm-hmm. Little Dom's really captured the design just perfectly to a point of that time travel experience. And I was always very impressed as well with Sean McPherson's places. The Good Luck Bar was a wonderful place to time travel, but it's very, they're few and far between. Some are just maybe overdone or just too much, and it kind of takes it into a bit of a modern, future realm, whereas staying like super, super authentically, you know, period correct, I guess you'd say, you know, those are the kind of the difference, even though they're thematic and whatnot. But so those are a couple of my favorites.
Okay. Yeah. Those are amazing, amazing historical places. I wanted to ask you about, I've heard in other interviews you've done, you talked about what a struggle the Formosa Cafe project was, you know, a lot of difficulty with that. Have there been any that you could talk about that you guys wanted to do, but that didn't come to fruition because of similar struggles?
The latest, I would say, would be the Chili Bowl on Pico. Because of what we've done with LA, we get a lot of people that, you know, are always contacting us. Hey, can you save this? Hey, you should save this place. And I'm like, yeah, I know we should. And I wish we could, but we don't always have the bandwidth to do it. I almost wish there were a few other groups helping out. And there are a bit. I mean, you know, the Apple Pan is in good hands. But the Chili Bowl was, you know, one of just a handful of programmatic architecture structures left. And sadly, it's been chopped up. Last month, basically, it got chopped up. And a lot of people had made phone calls, and I had made phone calls to the land use attorney there and other people. The LA Conservancy, I've had many conversations with them. And the will was there, you know, even if we couldn't take over that location, because the location was slated for a development. The development could not be stopped because there wasn't enough support with city council and whatnot to make this building a historic landmark. But it could have been moved. And so we, you know, looked into possibilities of moving it. Moving places in LA is pretty tough because land is at a premium and at a minimum. So finding a location to actually move a historic structure to is not easy. And so that one, the timing and everything else just didn't work out. We didn't have a place to put it. The timing didn't work out. The demolition couldn't be stopped. And sadly, who knows what state it's in now. So there's that one. The other one I'd say would be the Tamale, you know, in South Montebello. I've been down there with some preservationists and toured it. The Tamale, if people don't know, is it's a little building. It's a giant tamale. and it opened, they served tamales. There's some amazing historical photography of that place in the 30s, but it's still there. It's fantastic. It's still there. And I know it's being fairly well preserved. But as much as we would love to do something there, I always try to stick with what I know. And even different parts of Los Angeles can be so different. And, you know, Montebello, frankly, is never, I didn't grow up around there. It's not really a place that I know much about. And I feel like the Tamale would be best served by someone from the community bringing some new energy into it. You know, I think it could be an incredible, creative, gourmet tamale place again. But it would take somebody, who loves it and knows the community well to do it. And so that's one place that we've kind of had our eyes on the radar, but not quite jumped in yet.
So, Bobby, are you familiar with the Valley Relics Museum?
Oh, of course. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So, do they have something like that for LA? Because the first one you mentioned, the Chili one, you said they cut it up. I mean, did they not keep the structure and put it in some type of storage? Or?
Well, I mean, from what we've been told, the deal that the property owner made with the city council was that, hey, I'll cut this thing up and I'll preserve it somewhere in storage. We don't know if that's actually the case or not. I mean, I had several friends down there photographing the place as it was getting torn apart. It didn't look to me like too much really could have been saved other than the sign and maybe some doors and windows. But, you know, the stucco got completely knocked off the framework. And then, you know, the framework was a pile of 2x4. So, you know, I mean, of course, anything could be rebuilt, but, you know, there's something about the ghosts and the spirits that live in original structures that make a difference in the end.
That's true.
There is still another Chili Bowl on San Fernando in Glendale. we'll see what happens with that. And I think for most people, the Chili Bowl wasn't that as unique. You know, it wasn't the bulldog. It wasn't the barrel or a giant hot dog. It was a round building, you know, and that was a bowl. So I don't think it was quite as unique to most Angelenos. It wasn't the Derby, you know, it wasn't a giant hat, but still sad to see it go.
Yeah, I think we got to create an LA Relics Museum. I've had Tommy from the Valley Relics Museum on the podcast. He's an amazing person, by the way.
Tommy's wonderful.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, what he's doing over there is awesome. So, I mean, like you said, the original structure, definitely that would be best, but it would break my heart to see these things just being trashed. You know what I mean? Like at least put them in a museum. And I never really thought about it until you were just talking about it. But I don't know if they have anything like that for LA, similar to what he has in the Valley.
Yeah, they don't. It wasn't up until last year. We had a museum for the movies.
Yeah, that's true. I mean,
if you think about, I've been saying that for years, like how does Hollywood not have a museum about Hollywood? It
that's
is
weird.
The silliest thing I've ever heard in my life. And so now we suddenly have the Academy of Motion Picture Museum. You know, LA, you know, doesn't take a very good job of taking care of itself. I think LA's been on a speed train to the future for way too long, and never really stopping to look back, you know. And it's that kind of mentality that created LA. It's like we made movies. And so in order to make movies, you build incredible things and then you tear them down and throw them in the dumpster. And then what lives on are the images of those things. And I feel like that mentality has grown into a city with the same mentality. You know, now it's old, let's tear it down and let's build something new. It's like, let's make a new movie. And until that stops, until that train slows down and people start looking around a little bit, we're headed towards a very bland looking city. And it'll be the first time in the history of Los Angeles that it is this bland and boring. And I know that not only from my own personal experience, but all the research I've ever done.
Yeah, that's so true. Because there's a lot of misconceptions about Los Angeles from people who just visit and don't live here. Like you don't realize until you live here for years. And I think one of the biggest is, you talked about it, is history. People think LA has no history and culture. But when you get here and you start researching it, you're just like blown away. Like everything, every nook and corner of the city has so much history. But you're right. There doesn't seem to be a lot of emphasis on preserving it.
No. And LA has the most unique history of any city in America. We don't have the traditional history, you know, that Chicago and New York and all these other cities have, which, you know, built these old marble empire buildings, you know, from the starting in the, you know, 1700s, because we're a new young city. But we've also done things that no other city in America has ever done. You know, we built a city designed around the automobile. I mean, just imagine that.
Yeah.
Every other city in America was designed around a horse. And so that alone is, you know, one thing that makes LA so unique. We really need to stop and glamorize it more and talk about it more.
Yeah, maybe give a little more attention to these conservation groups. Because now that I think about it, I have talked to people in the past who are involved in LA conservation groups. So give them a little more attention and support.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, so let's jump into your perfect day in Los Angeles. So I'd love to ask my guests, as this is the last question, what would you consider your perfect day in LA? From getting up to going to bed, where would you go and what would you do?
Well, I know that's a tough easy one. No, it's not tough at all. Okay. Well, I don't know if he knows about me, but I'm a hardcore car guy. You know, I think my love of vintage probably started with cars and grew into everything else. So my perfect day in LA, which honestly I've only had a few times in life. I would say when I first started driving, the first several years I started driving, this was in the mid to late 80s. I had a 57 Chevy and I could drive anywhere. There were days I would drive to Malibu and then to Long Beach and then back to the Valley, and or then we'd go to Hollywood that night and go to the bars, or I would just, you know, wake up and drive over the canyon, Topanga, you know, go to the beach. That started to go away. You know, I started getting confined to a clock and worried about what time I was leaving or what time I'd be coming home. And that has slowly gotten worse my entire life. I did get a sense of that a bit in the first few months of 2020, when we had the lockdown, COVID lockdown in Los Angeles. It's the only time since the 80s that I could literally drive anywhere all day. And it was only actually 20 minutes. I'd go from my house to Long Beach, and I'd go from Long Beach to Malibu, and then I'd go over the hill. And honestly, the great frustration as of being a car guy and wanting to just go without stopping, it is so frustrating to live in LA in the days and times of traffic that we're living in. So honestly, my perfect day would be that. I would wake up, I would get into one of my vintage cars, and I would just be able to drive with minimal stops and see all of Los Angeles, you know, from the South Bay to along the coast, all the way to the Valley and around into Pasadena. And it would be enjoyable. And it would not be exhausting. And that honestly would be my perfect day.
That sounds like a dream day. And you're so right. During the quarantine, that's when I truly realized that everything in LA is actually 20 minutes away. It's just without traffic.
Yeah. Yeah. You're so right. And we live by the clock, you know, you know what times you have to leave and what times you got to get back.
All right, Bobby, thank you so much for coming on. Where's the best place for people to go and find out about 1933 Group? Because you've got so many bars and restaurants. What's the best place to go where people can find out about all of them?
I imagine it would be our website, 1933group.com, or just Google, you know, Google us, 1933 Group. There's probably all kinds of interesting articles that pop up.
Yeah, definitely. Lots of articles on you and everything you're doing at the 1933 Group. Thanks so much for coming on, Bobby. It was great talking to you.
Great talking to you, Stefan. All right, keep up the good work.
All right, thank you.
Okay, guys, welcome back. So I've got a confession to make for those of you who listen every week. I might have sounded a little different during that interview. And that's because during this conversation with Bobby, I had the flu and I was absolutely dying to get through the whole thing. But like I said in the intro, I've been wanting to interview him since I first started the podcast. So there was no way in hell I was going to cancel or reschedule. So I didn't mention it to him. I just plugged in and got through it as best as I could. And so glad I did, because Bobby was awesome and it was so great to hear his story directly from him. I truly admire people like Bobby Green and his partners, who not only create amazing experiences for us all to enjoy, but truly help to preserve the important history of this awesome city we live in, that we love, called Los Angeles. If you want to find out more about all the exciting projects they're involved in, you can find them on Instagram at 1933 Group or on their website, 1933group.com. Okay, on to my hack for this episode. So there are so many incredible bars and speakeasies in Los Angeles, but I've noticed something. A lot of the really, really good ones are done by these hospitality groups, and most of them do multiple projects. So if you love these experiences like Bobby and I discussed, where it feels like you've been transported to another time, another place, I'm going to share some of these groups with you, and then I want you to look up their names and check out all the projects that they are associated with, and then in turn go check out those places. So, of course, number one is the 1933 Group with today's guest, Bobby. I don't know of any collection of bars and restaurants here in LA that are done better. So just Google 1933 Group and you'll find the 12 to 15 incredible places that they have. He talked about some of them on this episode, but there's even more. We didn't have time to go into all of them, but check out anything by the 1933 Group and then find that list and make sure you go check out those bars and restaurants, because they really are next level experiences. Okay, next up, I want you to look up the Houston Brothers. So they've created some incredible speakeasy experiences here in Los Angeles, like Break Room 86, Black Rabbit Rose, La Descarza, Good Times at Davy Wayne's, and even more. So if you love a great speakeasy, definitely Google Houston Hospitality Group Los Angeles and see the full list of incredible places they have created, and make sure you go check them out. Okay, next we have the Neverlands Group. Now, they own two of the oldest and most historic venues, the Edison and Clifton's, both in downtown Los Angeles. Like I said, they're both downtown, they're both massive, and both of these places are absolutely mind-blowing. So definitely look up the Neverlands Group and those two incredible places to go check out. Okay, guys, there are more hospitality groups that do a great job here in Los Angeles creating these bar and restaurants experiences, and anything they are involved in is probably worth checking out. Another one I can think of off the top of my head is the Wish You Were Here Group. They create more of these beautiful venues that are a little more modern, probably less speakeasy and time transportation like the ones I mentioned before, but they're also worth checking out, the Wish You Were Here Group. So there's a lot more, but if you wanna check out the ones that kind of take you back in time and make you feel like you're living history, then definitely check out the first three I mentioned, 1933 Group, the Houston Brothers, and the Neverlands Group. They are responsible for some of the most incredible and mind-boggling nightlife experiences you can get right here in LA. Okay, guys, that's all I have for you this week, and I'll talk to you again next time.